Welcome to Leadership Bites with myself, your host, Guy Bloom. This is a leadership podcast where I have conversations with colleagues, I chat with guests, and sometimes they'll be just me talking. You can connect with me at livingbrave.com, and when you enjoy the episode, subscribe and please tell everyone. There you go, Mike. So, Mike, great to have you on this episode of Leadership Bites. Welcome to the podcast. Well, this is, I have this privilege of having a podcast where I get to ring people. And if somebody said there's a bloke called Guy Bloom on the phone, he'd like to have a couple of hours of your time, of course, people would go, oh. But if I go, I've got this podcast, then I get to speak to people. So it's this beautiful gift of being able to speak to people that I'd like to speak to and spend some time doing it. So I'm going to take that time with you. Now, I would love you just to introduce yourself to an audience that may very well not know who you are. We're based on in the UK, you're in the US. And just give that sense of who you are and in essence, where you put your energy and your focus.
Time you have, Guy.
Boom.
And I hate that question because there's so much. I'm a research doctor. I'm based in New Jersey in the U.S. and in Tampa, Florida. I had an office in Key West, Florida. But I've been an entrepreneur for 30 years. I've had a bunch of different companies. We have three medical clinics. We have a travel medical clinic and two standalones. How I got into COVID was just kind of by happenstance. We can get into that. But, you know, I do a lot more. I play some baseball. I'm going down to Yankee camp this week with the Yankees. I do all their fantasy camps or tournaments. I do stand-up comedy. I've been doing that for over 20-something years. I'm a private pilot. I'm a former police officer. Entrepreneur is a broad term, so it confuses a lot of folks sometimes.
So now you've made me feel fundamentally inadequate, so thanks for that. But So listen, you have a book called Fauci's Fiction, and I'm going to start gentle for, in essence, what may be a more of a UK audience. I do have quite a few people in the US, but I just would like you to, you know, we all know what COVID was. We all had that experience. For some, it can already seem like a thing of the past, but I think there's so much that went right with it and stuff that went wrong with it. There are so many truths and untruths, and there is, you know, and this is not with my tinfoil hat on, I think there are lessons to be learned, and who knows what happens next year with the next thing that happens. Who do we trust and who do we don't trust? And there's quite a lot of questions that need to be understood and answered. So you have a book called Fauci's Fiction, and I think it wouldn't be a bad thing just to explain to people, maybe in the UK, who do not know who Fauci is.
So Anthony Fauci is the head of the NIH. You know, and it's funny. So the book, Fauci's Fiction, isn't really about Anthony Fauci. He gets the brunt of the book because he was kind of the face of COVID during COVID in the U.S. He had Dr. Birx up there with him. Dr. Walensky, the head of the CDC, was often at the podium or you know, talking about, you know, what's going on in COVID. But Fauci was the face here in the U.S. So he gets the brunt of the cover here. He's only mentioned in the book three times. So people are going to be very disappointed if they think this is a hit piece on Anthony Fauci. It's not. The data inside the book doesn't make him or anybody else look so good. I would think, you know, he's kind of gotten this aura now. Now he's on Capitol Hill. He's answering some questions and hell only knows where that's going to go. A lot of people, he's kind of world renowned now. Infamous, I'll say, for Anthony Fauci. Not so much famous, but more infamous.
So just explain maybe a couple of things. Who is he? And even if it's not all about him, what was he representing?
Well, he was the head of the NIH. He worked in the government
Years. Just who is that for the UK audience?
So the National Institute of Health. So that's an infectious disease, which I don't know how that equates. You know, we have the CDC, Centers for Disease Control. I don't know, you know, what your departments are there, but he's the go-to guy for the president of the United States. He's the go-to person for the president and the cabinet to say, hey, what's, you know, during a pandemic, what's going on? How can we mitigate this? He did a lot of work during the AIDS epidemic back in the 80s. So he got pretty famous for that. But he'd been in government forever. So when COVID reared its ugly head, you know, everybody kind of looked toward him and Dr. Birx and Dr. Walensky and said, what, you know, the Surgeon General at the time, you know, they looked to figures like that to say, where do we go with this whole thing? And he really became the guy that was very well known on TV every day doing the White House briefings that became synonymous with the word COVID.
And to not make it about him, but he'll be part of the narrative, I'm sure. And the reaction, you know, the world had a reaction to COVID, which could be argued from the sublime to the ridiculous. And even listening to some of the things that seem to be happening in the US, depending on which state you were in. If you're in Texas, you were probably having a different experience than if you were in California, for example. So, and I just think about people's reaction to it over here as well, the many similar things. Do we start this story with a timeline? Is that the best way to kind of say, you know, on there was a day before COVID and then it became a thing, and maybe we pick it up there and I'll let you sure. kind of run with that.
Yeah. And that's kind of how the book transpires. The book is laid out that way. It's I start off the book with perspective because I think it's very important. Most people have a myopic view of COVID, whether it happened, something happened to them or something that happened to a family member or a friend. You got to put something in perspective, right? So we have 19,000 patients. We did 44,000 plus COVID tests. I had over 4,000 positives. That puts it, our perspective a little different. But when this started, it started a little differently for everybody else in the world. You know, we were over here in the U.S. looking at Europe, looking at Italy and seeing what's going on out of China. And most people kind of discounted it. No one was really talking about this in January of 2020. Nobody was really talking about it in February of 2020. They didn't give COVID its name, SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19, until February 12th of 2020. And for most folks here in the U.S., at least, you know, they thought it was a passing fancy. This is something that's over in Europe. And yeah, we've heard this before, basically. You know, it's the hurricane warning where they evacuate and then it never comes. And, you know, of course, the fifth time is when their house gets destroyed and they decided not to leave. For me, it was a little different. I'm watching this and we're in the middle of a political cycle in the U.S. We were at the end of 2019. I had gotten very sick in January of 2020 when we weren't testing for COVID yet. People forget the beginnings of this thing. And I'm watching what's going on. I called my wife. She was my girlfriend at the time. And I said, hey, you need to go to the store and pick up some stuff. And she's like, what are you talking about? I said, this thing's going to blow up. I was also an advisor on a political campaign for our Congress. Hoped to be congressman here. Fortunately, he lost that year. I was a senior advisor to David Richter in the 3rd District in New Jersey. And I had a meeting with him and the campaign manager one day. And I said, this thing in Europe is serious. It's going to come over here. It's going to be, you know, it's no joke. And they kind of looked at me and both discounted it, just like everybody else in the country, like, hey, no, come on, this is going to blow over. And I said, no, there's something different about this. The way it's being handled is, in my opinion, going to take over here. This is something that people are going to start getting freaking out. You know, that's the best word to probably describe it. And they both kind of discounted that. And I did some regression analysis charts early on to look at transmissibility. So I ran a chart for a buddy of mine, my buddy Phil down in Florida. I'm sitting down. I'll never forget this. I wrote on a post-it note the numbers of what I expected the cases to be in 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 6 months, a year. And he looked at me and said, there's no way. Nobody thought this was going to be a thing. And he still calls me to this day and tells me 4 years later, he says, I'll never forget looking at that post-it note. He says, I still have it. And I can't believe how right you were with those numbers. He said, how did you know? I said, simple math. It's regression analysis. We can, you know, you could all figure this out if you kind of look at other countries. We looked at other countries that had, I think, up to 1,000 cases at the time. And there was only maybe 8 of them. And we were looking at the, you know, the transmissibility and how high this thing, how quickly this thing was spreading. So to start off, you know, back in January and February of 2020, nobody really had a clue. But I was ramping up. And there's something that we did in our office, Guy, that a lot of doctors don't do. It's called a respiratory pathogen panel. Now, there's great doctors out there who know what this is. But in most cases, and especially in the U.S., there's no money in primary care, right? So you get 7 minutes with a doctor. They don't really take their time. If you come here sometimes, you know, you go to the primary care doctor during the, you know, flu season, you're going to wait an hour, sometimes 2 hours to see the doctor. And the reason is doctors overbook because there's no money in primary care. They have to see 100 plus patients a day sometimes in order to pay for their office staff and their overhead before they even see a profit. So the care is very short. It's 7 minutes. It's in and out. It's quick. That's the average in the U.S. when you're, you know, primary care visit. We don't practice like that. We like to take our time with our patients. We want to make sure that we see our patients on time. If you have an 11 o'clock appointment, we're seeing you at 11 o'clock. And we do a lot of ancillary testing. One of those things is called a respiratory pathogen panel. So my patients knew what COVID swabs were long before the rest of the world did, because if you had come to me sick before that, we were going to swab you. It was going off to the lab. And now, I don't remember at the time how many things were on the panel, but now there's 31 things on the panel that would include COVID-19. So we would identify if you had a flu or cold, you know, a different coronavirus or seven we test for, a bacterial infection. So if it's bacterial, we knew exactly how to treat you. So when COVID kind of came around, one of the labs that I work with was one of the first 30 in the nation to get FDA approval to do testing. And they called me up. And now, of course, the world is starting to shut down in about early March. Everybody is shutting down here. I mean, when I say shut down, it was, everybody was talking about, is air travel going to stop? You know, people are flooding the stores now. They were talking about cases in the U.S. What do we do? And one of the labs called me when I was down with Phil doing that posted note chart for him and said, hey, we're going to start COVID testing next week. Do you have any interest? I said, absolutely. We had the supplies already. We knew how to do this. We have been doing RPPs for years. And by happenstance, we were the first company in New Jersey to do a COVID test. And we're probably the only company for quite a few weeks because nobody knew how to do this or had access to the labs that we did. So by happenstance, we became the first company to do a COVID test and collected a lot of early data very quickly, which painted a much different picture than what you were seeing on television.
So what was the reality in your eyes compared to the message that you were seeing?
So let me make a couple points. One, and I hate to say this, the book is not politically motivated. There's no political overtones in the book. The book is just data. So when you say, you know, what in my eyes, it wasn't in my eyes. It was the data. The data doesn't lie. I'll tell you what we saw, and you can make your own decision from there. And you got to understand too, it's not like it's here and now. You wanted to timeline this thing, guys, so we can timeline it, and it makes more sense that way, because people now like to go back 4 years later and they'll say things to me like, well, hindsight's 2020. No, I'm on record as early as March and April of 2020 saying that this thing wasn't going to be as bad as what you were hearing on TV based on our data. So we're out and we're testing the first week of patients. You got to understand our perspective. We're geared up, right? We're PPE'd up. I'm calling patients. I'm going to their homes because they're not allowed out. Everybody's locked down. And I'm driving up and down the parkway. We have the Garden State Parkway in New Jersey. There's no cops on the road. There's no people on the road. I'm doing 100 miles an hour back and forth between homes. But we're running out of testing supplies daily. So whatever I had to start with, we're calling the lab every day saying, what can you send me? And there was a worldwide shortage of supplies. So some days I'd only have 5 or 10. I remember one day from the hospital, I got 40. And I was like, that was a gold mine. I had 40 test kits because that would run out by Tuesday if I started on a Monday. And at the end, some weeks I would have to turn hundreds of people away because we just didn't have testing supplies. So you're just kind of doing them one at a time. So I might be doing 5 a day, 10 a day, 20 a day, 17 a day, whatever the number is. But that first grouping of patients that first week, we didn't know what to expect. I'm telling people to come out on your porch. I want to test you outside. I don't want to be in your home. I'm messed up. I got an N95. I got a surgical over that only to hold the N95 on. I got gloves on. I'm outside. I'm swabbing. It's, you know, you're disinfecting, putting the samples together, sending them off to the lab, and you don't know what to expect. Well, the next day you're seeing these results come in and you're seeing a bunch of positives and a bunch of negatives because people were testing, just, you know, telling you they had symptoms. And this is important too. In the U.S., you had to have a medical necessity to test in the beginning. So we had these long lines of people, you know, a couple months in, and the signs that said no symptoms, no test. You had to have a medical necessity. That didn't change until the CARES Act came out, and the CARES Act in the U.S. said anybody at any time could get a COVID test. So for the first couple of weeks, you had to have a symptom, but there were a lot of people who would just tell you, yeah, I got something brewing, and you know, it's, oh, I got this cough, and they really didn't, whatever. But you're seeing all these numbers come in. So now you're calling the patients and you're giving them their positive or, you know, results. So positive results, you're calling up and you're recording symptomology. you know, guy, you know, I got a positive result. How you feeling? And you might be telling me, yeah, I'm just, you know, yesterday I was crappy, but today I'm fine. Put it in perspective, the first couple you do that's 75 years old, you're a little nervous because they're older, right? So you're testing them. They got a little fever. They got a cough. You're calling them the next day to confirm the positive. And then you're calling them the following day to find out how they're feeling. And they're telling you, yeah, not too bad. The fever broke. So then the next day you're calling them saying, well, what now? And they're going, yeah, we feel pretty good. And they're asking you for advice. They're saying, what do we do now? And I made up a joke and I said, take a cruise. They're cheap because nobody was on cruises at the time. And you start to realize that the next week you're telling the people the next week what you saw the first week and then, you know, so on and so on and so on. So by the time you get to 4 weeks of testing and you're realizing that no one's dying from this and you're realizing that when you put the aggregate together, right, when you put the aggregate, there's a lot of data here that's going to make some sense. The first grouping of patients that we did were 441 home visits while everybody was locked down. Now, if somebody was symptomatic in the household, every single person in the household would have it, but 85 to 90% of that grouping would be asymptomatic or mild. And we can get into and explain that. But 100% of the time, if somebody was symptomatic in a household, everybody had it. So these are the things that stick out in your mind, right? So as you're talking to people and someone's saying to you later, my husband had it and he was really bad, but I never had it. And I'm saying, did you live in the same house? And they said, yeah. I said, you had it because we know 100% that this thing spreads. But 85 to 90% of the populace who has it is asymptomatic or mild. That depends on how you define mild, because mild, if you define mild as not needing hospitalization, we only had 4 out of 4,000 positives go to the hospital. That's it. So 0.0001. If you define mild as not having a symptom, well, I mean, symptomology is subjective, right? It's not just observable, it's reportable. So a lot of patients or a lot of people would like to discount that data and say, well, it has to be the PCR test, and the PCR tests aren't accurate. That's not true. They're very accurate. The difference is you have to understand testing in totality. You have to understand a couple things. See, COVID guy isn't just negative or positive. COVID is either negative or positive with caveats. And what we've learned is those three caveats. One is CT value, that's your viral load. It becomes very important in understanding symptomology and how sick you may or may not get. Co-infection is the second caveat, and comorbidity is the third. The majority of folks who had a sickness, who had a classic symptom during COVID, who were sick with it, had a co-infection. Usually it was Staph aureus, which is a respiratory staph infection. To put it in perspective, I had a guy a couple years ago, I write about him in the book, he came back positive with COVID, staph, H flu, and RSV all at the same time. Now, if this guy was, you know, going to a local grocery store to get a home test at some point and thought he just had COVID, his myopic perspective would have been COVID's the worst thing in the world. But this guy was sick because he had four things going on in his system at the same time.
Okay. So
a lot, I know.
No. I mean, all of this is going to be a lot, but that's okay. So this comes out, gets given a name, we call it COVID, the world starts testing for it, and then something seems to happen, which is, and I'm going to use the word a mind virus, where people start to hear a message that basically this is fundamentally dangerous, all the way through to deadly. Now, it feels as if there are a couple of things going on, and again, you're going to correct me because you actually know, is that there seemed to be a version of COVID that then went into other strains as we went through this, and it became sort of like the first version of it, version one, let's call it, seemed to be the one that seemed to have the impact, and then we seemed to get other versions of it that maybe didn't hold as much impact. I don't know if that's accurate. But the reaction to the first one was, or has been, lockdown. To a point that doesn't seem to relate, and this is where people become confused or angry or whatever. It seemed to be that if you were obese, if you were of an age, if you already had some form of respiratory issue, then yeah, you probably do need to be careful. And there may be much more to that than I've just said. And then it seemed to be that if you were relatively young or just, you know, just not old, but you were relatively fit, the chances are you were going to be fine. Now, so how did it go from everybody just be careful, it is what it is, to a literal mind virus? How did that stepping stone happen? Or is it, Guy, I still don't know, but it did?
Oh, no, we know. And there's a lot to unpack in what you just said there. Let's take it one at a time. You mentioned the different versions of COVID. So let's start there. I explain this in the book. What is a virus, right? Because people 4 years in, if you're going through, and this is what pisses me off, right? You're going through a national, worldwide pandemic where everyone could die. From the start, you think, and this is why Fauci gets the cover of the book and everybody else, you think from the start, they would tell you the basics. The basics are very important here. There's timelines. What is a virus? So a virus itself, it's not a living thing. And science will debate this, but the reason why science will tell you that viruses are not living things is because they can't get together and have little baby viruses. They're not technically classified as parasites. They're like parasites, but in that vein, they need a host to survive. So a virus is like kind of like an amino acid. The particle's either active or inactive. When it goes into your system and binds and starts replicating, it starts making copies of copies of copies of copies. If you were to take a piece of paper and make a copy on a copier and then take that copy out and make a copy of that and so on and so on and so on, eventually it would get so distorted, it would burn itself out. You wouldn't recognize it. But what happens, sometimes it develops this weird shape on the outside of it, and that's the spike protein mutating. Now, inside the capsium of that virus, okay, or the envelope, let's call it, there's about 27 proteins. It's a very small amount. And inside, that doesn't change. That's SARS-CoV-2. That's COVID, right? The spike protein is what mutates, and most of the versions of COVID you've never heard of because they're not binding in human cells. And I really hate the CDC in this country. They've gotten most of everything wrong. The one thing I give them credit for, and it's probably one guy in a basement somewhere, is predicting the predictability of the ones that are going to bind. Right? They'll tell you this version, the Omicron, you know, looks like this one's going to bind, and this will be the next thing. That guy's done a good job. Everybody else at the CDC, I forget it. But that guy, I want to give him credit. I don't know his name. I'll just call him Bob. Bob's done a great job. So people need to understand viruses and how they mutate. So viruses aren't looking to kill you. Viruses, though, by definition, the moment they enter your system, are mutating the moment they enter your system, looking for the best version of themselves to survive, right? So you haven't heard of a lot of these other things. And when you talk about the original, what we saw in the beginning was the L strain and the S strain. Then we got into Delta, and then we got into Omicron. But again, SARS-CoV-2 is SARS-CoV-2. People always, this is kind of like a misconception. People in the office, when I would call them and tell them they're positive, they would say to me, I'd say, you're positive for COVID-19. And I had one woman say to me, oh my God, the OG? And I said, what does that mean? She goes, the original COVID-19? She goes, not Delta or Omicron? I said, ma'am, you're asking an irrelevant question. That testing, that isn't done at the practitioner level. It's not even done at the lab level. That's a CDC thing where they kind of look and see what the most, you know, predominant strain is. But SARS-CoV-2 is SARS-CoV-2. What people don't realize is that when you get COVID, you're getting sick. You're getting an antibody response, which, by the way, we've measured, and it lasts for on average about 120 days. I've had people last a year, and I've had people last a couple of weeks. But the average, the mean, is 120 days. It's about 4 month antibody response. When you, after the antibody response, you get what's called B and T lymphocyte response, or B, your memory cells. B cells are your memory cells, your T cells are your helper cells. And you're getting that memory response to all of the proteins inside the capsium of that virus. So the next time you get it, when the spike protein mutates, like in Omicron or Delta, and you catch it again, your body has gotten fooled by that spike protein. But once it enters your system, you have memory to the majority of the proteins inside that virus, which is why it's less virulent time and time again. When we talk about the beginning, when people weren't doing well with this thing, it was a novel virus. If you and I were to go to an indigenous island and hug all the people there, they'd probably get sick and die off from things that we're immune to, but you know they've never been exposed to. So novelty is a big deal. The second big deal is we didn't know how to treat this thing. We were using flu protocol, which flared COVID up, ironically. So certain things like Tamiflu was known to or suspected to flare it up, so we stay away from Tamiflu when it comes to COVID. This is stuff practitioners haven't kind of picked up
yet. And we were incubating as well, weren't we? And that wasn't helping.
What do you mean?
Is that right? Is it where we were putting people in oxygen tents, yep, and
Well,
I don't know if the word is ventilating. I do apologize.
Yeah, we were venting people way too early. They were bucking. It's called bucking the vent, and it's kind of weird to see. But when you are when your body is having what's called a cytokine storm, that's when you're getting over inflammatory response. What we learned early on, there was a doctor who tried to calm the immune system, immunosuppressant therapy, and it worked very well because people were their immune system was having an over response, an over inflammatory response, and their organs were shutting down, and that's what you were seeing. So you had to calm the immune system down. So now we use steroids and things of that nature, but throwing somebody on a vent too early was detrimental. We just didn't know, but that guidance again was coming from Fauci, the CDC, the NIH, Dr. Walensky. And that's why again why he gets the brunt of the cover of the book. There were so many things that we kind of knew very early on that they weren't telling you, and we would watch television. We would see what they were saying in a press conference because we're all curious too, but it didn't match what we were seeing on the ground. And a lot of times it would take them 6 months, 12 months, sometimes 18 months to catch up to what we were seeing in our office. I mean, for instance, when the Johnson and Johnson vaccines, there was a big story on that with clotting, and they took it off the market for a couple weeks. We had been talking about clotting with the vaccines, and I know I'm jumping ahead here, for months. And we're looking at each other in the office going, are they just that dumb, or did they not have the information? Like, we've been talking about this on the ground for months, and here they are on television like it's a brand new story, but it happened every single day.
So regardless of anything else that might be medically relevant, when it comes to their messaging, my understanding is that they should have had a finger on the pulse. They should have the brightest and the best. They should be linked to the people who are literally at the pointy end of the spear, and they should be able to go, in a relatively quick pace of time. Okay, that was true yesterday, but it doesn't seem to be true today, etc. So what is it that led, do we know, to a narrative that didn't seem to match the reality of experience?
Well, see, I don't write about that in the book, but I'll be happy to talk about it and speculate. But I want folks to know that in the book, it's just the data. You can make your own decision at the end of the day. And this was a worldwide pandemic. We were seeing things in Italy. We were seeing things in Europe. We're going, wait a minute. And then when it got here, and you're seeing body bags and people locked down, and you have to understand a lot of things to put that in perspective, like timelines. COVID itself, pretty much any but respiratory pathogen, the incubation period for COVID is 3 to 5 days. So by the time you have it, or by the time you feel symptoms from it, you're about day four. But the virus can only sustain in your system for 14 days. So when you add 10 days of isolation to day four, you're at 14. You're at the end of the life cycle of the virus, but you can test positive for up to 90 days. So people were kind of using pseudoscience and misinformation. If this was all kind of disseminated early, it would have made a lot of sense. It would have stopped all the police chiefs from calling me saying, I need a negative test for my officer to come back to work. And you're going, no, that's not appropriate. Do you go back to the doctor when you have the flu and ask if you're over the flu? No. There were a lot of this basic stuff, and that's kind of why I start the book in the basics, because you need to understand all this. You need to understand timelines. So if you theoretically locked everybody in the world down for 3 weeks, you could stamp out the virus because it wouldn't have another host to jump to once it died off in each person. But we went about things kind of ridiculously. The lockdowns were kind of stupid. I'm not an advocate for lockdowns, by the way. And I'm not an advocate for lockdowns. Well, I will tell you that it would work in theory, right? If you locked every single human being on the planet down and didn't move them for 3 weeks, it would absolutely stomp out that virus. But you don't need to do that because we predicted the mortality rate of COVID would be about that of the flu. Early on, I think in April of 2020, we predicted the mortality rate after we had about 100, patients to gauge a small data set from. And I went, well, this is kind of dumb because you wouldn't lock down the entire world for a bad flu season, but they did in this instance with COVID. So we predicted a lot in the first month or two that could have mitigated, that could have stopped this entire exercise that the world went through. The biggest thing we didn't know is how to treat it. That took a couple months to figure out. That took into, May, June, July. And then, by then we kind of had a grasp of proning, not using flu protocols, changing the way we were would do this a little bit. We had a grasp, though, in about 4 months. But this exercise went on for at least 3 years. So, I mean, I had people calling me up who were friends of mine saying, my business is shut down. You know, in New Jersey, our governor was like a dictator. You know, so people are saying, what do we do? We got, you know, we're shut down. We can't work. I can't feed my family. And how long do you think this was going to last? They're asking me. And I tell them, that's 6 months. They'll figure it out. Because if we're there now, they'll get there eventually, but you know, as 6 months now, meanwhile, and then you're going on a year, 2 years and three, and these people are freaking out trying to, you know, just run their lives. You ask the question, why? I don't speculate, but we were in the middle of an election season, and you could kind of see it happening in front of you when the mask thing came out. Dr. Fauci said, nah, you shouldn't wear masks. Even the Surgeon General said the same thing. It's, people don't know how to wear them. They're not going to help you with the virus. We don't wear masks for viruses, okay? And I can explain all that to your audience. But they said the truth. And then all of a sudden, somebody asked President Trump, are you going to be wearing a mask? And he said, no, I won't be wearing a mask. The next thing you know, all of a sudden, they were mandating masks. It was like, what? It was like, you're watching this in real time. And if you're, you know, if you have half a brain cell, you can kind of see that there were forces at work here that wanted to make each other look bad during the pandemic. You know, even Trump, and I'll give him credit. He was correct when he said, I don't want the cure to be worse than the disease. But I think that our elected folks here who were against him realized he was a populist president, realized he likes to do things quickly, and realized he likes to do things a little bit, you know, not the traditional way. They realized that if they wanted to get a vaccine on the market, this is the guy to do it probably because, you know, he wants to look good. So I think a lot of folks were taking advantage of the political situation in our country, and that kind of just, you know, it blew up to a point of ridiculousness.
So I'm being careful not to take this down a political route because he is so polarizing generally as a Trump as a person, you know, it's either I think the guy's bloody great or, you know, he's Satan, right. You know, incarnate. There doesn't seem to be a lot of mid ground. It might very well be that, and let's not probably go down that rabbit hole too much, but there is something there that says actually then, if he'd have been a kind of standard president, we may have had a slightly different reaction, but there was such a polarized reaction for what he thought and for what he, and against it, that may have then potentially infected, for the want of a better word, the behaviour and the decision-making of a whole group of people, partly due to that those kind of things being true.
Yeah.
You can't necessarily put an exact quantity on it. You can't exactly give it an exact weight, but it definitely had a weighting.
Well, for the listeners in your country, in the UK, there are a big group of people here who, no matter what Trump says, they're going to tell you the opposite. Because they just feel like Trump, you know, he is polarizing to a lot of people. But it's, I mean, he could tell you the sky's blue and they'll come up with a reason to tell you it's not. You know, I mean, I'm being facetious here, but, you know, he could, and there's a line, you know, he could save a baby and they'd still, you know, find a reason to be upset with him. So it's kind of dumb. And you have to, but as a person who has, you know, an IQ over 100, which is, I mean, half the world doesn't. And there's a line in my book and I said half, and I talk about the US, but I said half the country, if the average IQ in the US is 100, if you think about that, half the country has an IQ of less than 100. That's pretty scary. And those are the folks that are usually easily swayed and, you know, they kind of just go with whatever way the wind blows. They don't really think for themselves. That's kind of scary when you think about it. And I always wondered where the critical mass was. Is it 50-50? Is it 60-40? Like what percentage of populace would have to go with a certain narrative before everybody else would have to follow along? And we've realized, I had my co-host the other day on Two Mics Live on my show, said, no, it's less than that. It's like 3-5%. He said, look at Germany during, you know, during Hitler, it was like 3-5% that moved an entire country in a different way. And I said, yeah, you're right. So it seems to be the loudest people. It's not always the smartest people. It's the loudest ones. And, that's kind of scary. And we, I guess, weren't loud enough. Well, when we saw what we were seeing with this data, and I'm seeing it affect my friends, shut their businesses down, kids out of school, suicide rates going up. We were trying to tell people what we saw. Not politically, just telling them, hey, look, I've got this many patients. They've all survived. This is the symptomology, because that's still something people don't understand. Symptomology is huge. You know the most common symptom of COVID is, Guy? It's a headache. It's a headache. Mm. It has to do with hemoglobin uptake issues. People don't still know that. So that's why I say symptomology is not just observable, it's reportable. If you come into my office, right, and I tell you you're positive for COVID and you don't have a symptom, now you're screaming at me thinking that it's a false positive. Now, I could test you four times on a PCR. It's going to come back positive. I could repeat the data over and over and over. But you in your mind and that myopic view are going to think that it's a false positive still because you don't have a symptom. It might take me a half hour before the conversation goes into, well, Guy, the most common symptom of COVID is a headache, before you look at me and go, you know, I have been having headaches. Because in your mind, you're thinking you have to have a classic symptom, a cough, a fever. This is what you're seeing on TV, right? This is what you're used to. It begs the question, this will blow your mind. And if you really think about this question, it'll blow your mind. When you look at the data in Meta and you understand symptomology and you understand that most people don't get a symptom from a respiratory pathogen, we're always fighting something off. Not always, but we're fighting stuff off a lot that we don't develop classic symptoms from because it hasn't destroyed the mitochondria of our cells. I asked the question one day, we didn't know this. We've never done mass testing on this scale. I asked my immunologist one day, I said, I wonder how many asymptomatic flus are walking around the world every year. And he goes, yeah, never thought of that. Because, you know, classically, if you're sick, you go to the doctor, they identify what it is and they treat it. You don't test everyone at flu season to see who has it. But here's what we did during COVID. We tested every single person on the planet to see who had it. And we found out that everybody had it. I've had it three times. I don't know how many times you've had it. There's still a lot of people who have that, again, myopic view that husband and wife, and the wife will tell me, my husband had it in the beginning. It was really bad. And I never caught it. And I go, yes, you did. And she's going, no, I would know. I would know. I have autoimmune. I said, no, you wouldn't know. Because 90% of people, 85 to 90%, didn't have a classic. You're constantly explaining this to people. And that's a problem. Because COVID has become so polarizing as well. It has become a political punching bag. It is one of those ping pong things that everybody likes to hit back and forth of their own view. When you have 19,000 patients, you really understand it in totality. So trying to explain this to every single person one at a time is very daunting. I called, to give you a little bit of perspective, I called every single positive patient for two straight years to give them their results. And when I did, I recorded symptomology. I had to talk a lot of people off the ledge in the beginning. So we recorded more data than I think anybody on the planet. And I also have something that's called horizontal data. That's where you test the same grouping of people over and over and over. So the police departments that I was forced to test every Wednesday, you have the same 100 cops every week. I can tell you in totality for 3 years, because we did that for 3 years in this one department, I can tell you how many times each person had it, what their CT value was, and we should talk about testing, what their comorbidities were and what their co-infections were, plus their symptomology, and put that in perspective to people. So I love when the wife who never thought she had it tries to argue with me that she didn't have it, even though her husband was direly sick. When I'm trying to explain to her that she had it and she wouldn't know, and that is the norm, they can't get that through their head. It's very, very frustrating. And that's why I put it all in this book, to try to kind of give you the basics. If you understood the basics, COVID makes a lot more sense.
So I'm going to ask I like to ask slightly silly questions, maybe sometimes, because sure. I realize I should know the answer. But here we go. What happened to the flu?
Yeah. I get asked that all the time. So, okay, the flu is still around. And we were probably going to have, the first year that we saw the flu, it was weird too. We were talking about this in the office. I'm calling my NPs, we're discussing it. We didn't see any flus for a while, right? But it's not like I saw a ton of flu all the time, right? It's not like, and a lot of people, if you think back to the way people kind of get desensitized to illness, most people, when they don't feel well, they don't go to the doctor. They just figure they have the cold or a flu, right? They're not running off to get a test. So I kind of had to think about this in different aspects. My co-host wanted to press me on this last week. When in the old days, if you got sick, you just stayed home. You didn't go to work. You didn't, you know, but if you got really, really, really sick and you felt like you needed something, then you would run off to the doctor. COVID kind of changed that. COVID, everybody was going to the doctor because everybody was fearful that this, you know, tightness or cough or mild whatever they were, headache, could have been COVID. So now they were running to the doctor to get tested. The flu, we didn't see any flus for about a year, or flu A and flu B. We were probably due for a very light flu season to begin with. a lot of people like to speculate that the COVID took over the flu. That's completely inaccurate. It's juvenile to actually say that. They're two different signals. Right now, I see lots of COVIDs. I see lots of flus. I see H1N1. You can see that very specifically on a PCR test. But so people who are speculating that the flu kind of took, or, you know, took a break, it took a break, but it wasn't like, you know, it disappeared. It's still out there. The labs that I work with did not see any flu A or flu B cases. We did, though, see H-flu, which is bacterial. It's not influenza. It's a little different. We did see Moroxella catarrhalis, Klebsiella pneumonia, all the other stuff we see, parainfluenza A. We didn't see a lot of viruses, though. We saw a lot of bacterial strains. So what I think happened that year, because the R-naught of COVID is so high, it spreads quicker than most things. I think that was the predominant strain of virus that was running around the world at that time. And that's why you saw COVID more over the flu. Now we see a little bit of everything. We were seeing a lot of RSVs toward the end, but in the beginning, no viral pathogens were really popping out. It was just COVID, and then a bunch of bacterials. Now you kind of see it has evened out.
And what's the parallel between flu death rates and COVID death rates? If you actually were just going to look at it side by side and go, actually, it was less, it was more, what actually is the reality of that holding those two graphs next to each other?
It's about the same. We predicted that in the beginning. The flu is 0.01%. We predicted COVID would be around 0.02%. Not quite close to, but not quite double that of the flu. But you wouldn't, again, shut down the entire world for a bad flu season. Now you're seeing it's between 0.01 and 0.02. It depends on if you're grouping children versus, you know, older people. Let me give you a little perspective. If you're in the pool of population that's going to die in the next 5 years, if you're frail and you're fragile, COVID can bring you down, a flu can bring you down, cold can bring you down, RSV can bring you down. You want to try and not get sick. And we've learned so much from mass testing and going through this exercise. We're not applying it to all of, you know, the future of medicine. I thought we were going to make leaps and bounds, right? I thought like, wow, we got a really good, opportunity to sample size and do something we've never done. Like a lot of people on our side of the aisle, guy, they'll say, well, you know, I never got a test. I never wanted to get a test. And I'll say, well, that's stupid. Like, information is power. You should want to know what's going on, right? Information makes you smarter. It doesn't, like the pride of saying I never got a COVID test, like, that's stupid. You know, your pride is not helping anybody. When I got to, because when our state in New Jersey mandated testing in nursing homes, well, we picked up a lot of that work. I looked at it as a good data experiment, because this is an opportunity to really see it in real time and put paint COVID in a picture. So I wasn't like, you know, oh, this is going to be great and we can exploit this. No, I'm looking at it because I want to know. I want to know how deadly this is. I want to know what the common symptomology is. I want to know, you know, if you had a vaccine, if you were less sick, and we could talk about that as well. We learned a lot during this exercise. We're just not talking about it. And there seems to be still a political pushback. It's pretty scary that does not want to get this information out. I've done interviews in the UK before where they have put them up on YouTube, and they've been immediately taken down within the first 2 minutes. I have pushed this on Amazon as one of my distributors. They will not let me promote the book due to what they said is current events. Anytime I post something on Meta, which is Facebook or Instagram, it immediately gets suppressed. It's amazing that the suppression still goes on today.
Well, you've beaten me to my next question, which is this about, which is great, which is about how there was something going on here at a political level with social media which was about silencing, and people were not allowed to have an opinion unless it was the one that came from the state, right, which leads a whole group of people, you know, okay, we are talking about COVID, but there's something so heavily entwined in this, which is a sense of state control, a sense of manipulation, a sense of the adult not being allowed to have an opinion. And if we talk about the jab, you can say, well, it wasn't mandatory. Well, it kind of was if you wanted to go anywhere or do anything. Right. So, you know, you can, and for what I think became very, very scary was the people that, if we'd have been pre-social media, you know, then it would have just been, you know, believe, you know, it would have been 1984, believe what the state tells you and move on. Social media did allow things not to be hidden. And even though they were suppressed, you know, actually TikTok, which I know, you know, has its own kind of focus. But actually, you know, where did your source of true news come from? And I think now we've got a group of people that are almost, if another event like this happened again, the damage done to the level of trust about who I wouldn't believe, a pharmaceutical company, do I really want that jab? I had it. I'm 54, 55 years old. I haven't had a second one. And I only had it because I had to go and do work in certain places and I couldn't go there without the jab. So I would have my income. But if another virus happened and somebody said, you know, you've got to take this jab, do you know what? From what I've heard now about what it's been doing for certain people in their 50s, yeah, and this, that, is that true? Because one PhD seems to say it's a good thing. Another PhD seems to say it's a bad thing. Here's and I think deal. People have been left in a very, very unsure, who do I believe? And the level of distrust, it seems to be huge.
Well, here's the deal. When someone tells you their opinion, ask them what it's based on. Okay, if it's based on a CDC, you know, guidance or something, then say where's your data? You know, and I get really tired of these so-called experts on TV who claim to be experts. I write about a cardiologist in the book, and I was a little harsh. We were at dinner one night, and he's cardiology, we're primary care. And he said to me at dinner in front of a bunch of people, he said, you know, I used to recommend the vaccine all the time, but I don't anymore now that I see all the issues coming back with it. And I looked at him and I said, are you an idiot? And he's kind of like looking at me, where's this conversation going? I said, dude, you do cardiology. We're primary care. I said, have you ever tested for or treated a COVID patient? He's like, well, no. I said, well, what are you giving advice for on anything? Where are you basing that information on? I said, you know what? I said, when we have a heart issue in our office, we send them to you for a reason, because we don't know what you do. We're not experts in cardiology. So we just tell our patients, sorry, we're going to refer you out. And we try to refer to the best. I said, your best answer in that scenario should have been, I don't know. There were so many experts on TV that I could name and I won't. And I talk about some of them in the book, but I don't name them by name. I give one guy credit in the book, and that's Dr. Marty McCarry. He was pretty spot on during COVID. There were a lot of other ones that were spot on too. Jay Bhattacharya, you know, from the Great Barrington Declaration, which, by the way, we were like 10 months before those guys, but I think they were October. No, we were like 6 months before, but there were so many people giving erroneous information during this thing because they were basing it on what everybody else was saying and what they were hearing from the CDC. Nobody was basing it on the data that they actually had. I don't do oncology. So if you came into my office and asked me about cancer, we're going to send you to hopefully the best oncologist that we know that we can get you in with. But we're not going to speculate and give you an answer. That drives me nuts. So when one PhD says something, ask them what their information is based on. All right. I'm really specific in my office, and my credibility means something to me. I teach that to my staff when they first get hired. I always tell them this. I say, if I ask you a question and you don't know the answer, but you make something up because you want to appear smart, I said, you know, cognitive distortion is a big thing. You know, people don't want to appear wrong. I said, if I find out you're wrong, I'm going to question everything you ever tell me. And you don't want to be in that position. I said, if I ask you a question, you don't know the answer, tell me, I don't know. But then when you go find out, because I'll respect you a lot more and I will never question your credibility. So that's become a problem here. So I don't blame you for not wanting to get a jab. Look, here's why we didn't recommend vaccines. And let me put this in perspective. Again, I had 19,000 patients, 4,000 positives. Four of the 4,000 went to the hospital. That was it. Okay? Zero patients. We lost zero patients during COVID. All right? So if you had come to me and said, hey, Mike, you know, I'm thinking that they're talking about this thing, blah, blah, blah. Do I need this vaccine? All right. And we're going to discuss that in a minute. The laughing answer was no, because of two reasons. One, you didn't need it. Everybody was surviving this thing pretty easily. Okay. And two, it didn't work because once it started to come out, we recorded all that information as well. You know, when I'm on the phone in the beginning, it was two different. In the beginning, it was early, right? So in the beginning, in March or April or May of 2020, I would call you and say, guy, you're positive. And a lot of the times I'd get back from that patient, I don't understand how I'm positive. I've been wearing a mask the whole time. And you want to roll your eyes. Now, after the vaccines came out 6 months later, you would call positive patients and the information was was the same. I don't understand how I'm positive, but I got fully vaccinated. You should see it over and over and over. Perspective is real important. When people aren't doing this day in and day out like I was, their myopic view gets really distorted. They don't have a clue. But when you're calling positive patients every day that have been fully vaccinated, you start to realize, well, this thing's not working in practice. And then we started to measure antibody response from those people who were vaccinated. And guess what? Guess how long it lasted? I don't know if you remember how long it lasted in natural immunity. It was 128 days. Guess how long it lasted after the vaccine? 120 days. I'm sorry, 120 and 120. It was exactly the same. The difference being when you get COVID naturally, you get those B and T lymphocytes, that memory response. You don't get that from the shot. And also, we have to be specific, Guy, because when people say the word vaccine, and you say that to a 70, 80, 90-year-old person, that person is thinking like polio, lifetime immunity. They're thinking Hep B, 10 years immunity. When you get a 120-day antibody response, that's pretty much the same as a flu shot. So we were kind of derelict in our duties by calling this a vaccine. They actually changed the definition of the word vaccine in the middle of COVID to fit more what they were saying it was doing. And that's just reprehensible.
And you'll correct me on my language. So it wasn't an immunity. It didn't immunize you. It wasn't get the jab. And no. And that was something that even that simple piece of information got blurred because of A, the word, but also the message that we were hearing was that, oh, it does immunize you. But actually it turned out, no, it doesn't immunize you.
We knew this so even early.
Are you jabbed? And I go, what's it got to do with anything? Because if I get jabbed, it doesn't stop you getting it, and it doesn't stop me getting it.
Here so. You ever watch a movie where you're watching a horror movie and you know what's going on, but the characters in the movie don't know what's going on, and you're sitting back going, don't go in there, because the villain's in the other room. That's how I felt during this entire time. We knew so much of this stuff so early. We would talk about it amongst our colleagues. We would try to get it out. I would do radio down in Key West twice a week. And when I had an office down there and I would do these interviews and explain to them what we were seeing, they would literally on air, just like this, you can hear their eyes rolling and almost like, really? But this is not what we're hearing on TV. Everybody would discount your information. So, and it's amazing to me that when you're proven right 6 months later, a year later, 2 years later, they still don't want to admit it. They would look at you and go, well, you were guessing. And you're going, no, I wasn't guessing. I had real data. It's in the book. It's very frustrating to know this stuff early and try to prevent these things from happening.
So what is anything happening that is trying to fix, regardless of what, because something will come in due course, an asteroid will hit us or the next thing will come, something's going to happen. But the real thing is to rebuild trust in the mechanism that informs us. And is there actually actively, because you are one of others who were trying to go, hold on a minute, yeah, that isn't right. So how does that get repaired so the right people are being heard? Or is actually, do you know what, Guy, there's a lot going on here that's political, there's a lot here that's going on that's financial. So do you know what, it's probably just remember what happened last time is probably the best thing you're going to be able to do.
Well, look, we're 4 years into this now. 4 years. I can't believe that sometimes. And there are still people who don't know the difference between isolation and quarantine. They don't know timelines of a virus. They don't know some of the things we talked about how it mutates and what viruses really are and the timelines of how long it can stay in your system. We're 4 years into this. You think you would know the basics. So I think how do we fix it is, number one, educating yourself. But it drives me nuts. When I have a patient that comes in the office, I got schooled very early on by an epidemiologist who called me about a positive patient. He says, what did you recommend? I said, well, we quarantine him. And he goes, no, you don't quarantine somebody who's positive. You isolate him. And I was like, you're right. And I said, you know what? And I realized at that moment, it was really early. It was like March of 2020. I said, wow, if we're not all speaking the same language, we're going to have a problem here. Like, everybody needs to understand every little facet of this so that we could get beyond this. And still 4 years, it drives me nuts. Like, all the information's out there, but people find rabbit holes to go down. So number one, I think to fix that is education. Number two is we need to ask the appropriate questions. And I said that that question is based on what? And a lot of people don't ask that question. They take it at face value, whether it's Dr. Fauci giving advice, or you should wear two masks, three masks, five, based on what? You know, no one wants to ask that question. It's amazing how many people love to follow and crave leadership, but there's a lack of leadership out there. And the ones who have the unelected bureaucrats, that's where Anthony Fauci is. He wasn't elected. He was put in that position, making rules and not having any recourse by the people to go back and say, no, we don't agree with that. It's dangerous.
Now, my understanding is that that body in which he has oversight over controls a lot of funding.
Yeah, and he's retired now, just to be clear. But
yeah, and so there was a lot going on there with people feeling very vulnerable that if I raise my hand, I will receive a penalty that is could literally, you know, would hit me in the pocket. So I can understand how, again, there's a complication here that goes beyond the truth of what it is to the politic and the financials of what it is. One little thing that I would just like some clarity on is this whole idea of gain of function. And, you know, we have this, you know, I think it was Trump that was, you know, why do you call it a Chinese virus? And he said, well, because it came from China, which I thought was hilarious. Again, doesn't matter if you like the fella or not, you know, when he has a kind of a line of sight on something, you can see that he goes all in. And I can't remember the comedian that says, you know, why do you call it the Wuhan virus? Well, it came from a lab in Wuhan. So right next to a wet market. But, you know, whatever it is. So this gain of function, are we right in saying that Fauci did sign off on gain of function, which is, my understanding, is looking at viruses to see what will happen to them and actually creating a virus for the sake of creating it to see if it did manifest in that way so we can create antibodies. And he sanctioned that in a lab that he couldn't do in the US. And that lab then happened, it seems by all accounts, to be the lab that leaked. Do we know that? Is that relevant to this story, or is that just a byproduct of stuff? If you want to Google it, go and find out about it.
It's relevant to, it's not in the book. I don't go down that road. I mean, I give the medical data. I analyze the medical data, you know, so that we could kind of get the basics and go there. I don't go down the political narratives. If you want to talk about it, you know, I could tell you that they were trying to push a zoonotic release, which is, that's total BS. We have our data would point back to, and I've gone through this with multiple people where I've showed them how the mutations of COVID point back to a singular release event. Okay. And in my mind, and I think everybody is in agreement with me now, but for the first 2 years of this, I would have to argue with people who were saying, no, it came out of a wet market and it was a bat and it was zoonotic, because they were trying to push that. Anybody could see when you look at the data that this came from a singular release point. So when you would assume zoonotic, you would think that it would come out of multiple release points, right? Because if it was in an animal community and it was being spread, that it would come out of different areas, right? This kind of that narrative did not make sense. And I think most people are on our page now, but it was frustrating having to argue with them for a long time. People that this is always a problem. Like, I don't come to your job and tell you how to do it, right? Because I don't know how to do it. But there's everybody in the world. It's not just, you know, one particular, it's everybody in the world wants to come and tell you how to do my job because they think they understand it from, again, a myopic view or a report. They don't have the perspective we have. It's really sad. And I love to argue with accountants. Like, I don't show up at your job. I don't show up at your job at McDonald's and I had to flip the burgers. Like, dude, I wouldn't know how to turn the machine on. Like, it's not my thing. So it's a little frustrating. But I think that if you look at the data and it points back to a lab leak theory, when it comes into gain of function, I don't get into that, but I've talked about it ad nauseum with different television shows and hosts and things like that. Why are we doing this? Why are we trying to develop superbugs? If there can get out like this and cause what it caused, we still, and I applaud you for having this show, because there's a lot of people, like you said, are kind of over it. They have COVID fatigue. They don't want to talk about this anymore. There's a worldwide conversation. I can stop saying national when I'm doing your show in the UK. There is a worldwide conversation that we need to have about what happened, when it happened, what they knew, when they knew it, and how we can make this different. My last chapter in my book basically says if this were to happen again tomorrow, we would do things almost exactly the same way because we haven't learned a damn thing.
One of the most worrying things, regardless of what it is that comes next. It's the have we got better at dealing with it?
No. We haven't. When you look at the response and the they can change the response, right? I mean, they can come back and say, "Well, we did this wrong, we did that wrong." That's not happening. They don't want to look bad, so they're kind of sticking to what they did. And there's a couple people that have come out and said, we screwed up here, we screwed up there. But the big ones, even this vaccine thing. Why are we still pushing this vaccine? Again, it doesn't work. You don't need it. And here's the deal. And I have to be very specific about this. When you say that to the layperson, they automatically, and especially if they're political, they automatically want to jump down your throat and say, "Oh, you're an anti-vaxxer." Well, no, we're not talking about, first of all, we're not talking about a traditional vaccine. And you got to understand that vaccines are all different, right? We used to use attenuated vaccines, viral vector vaccines. This is an mRNA technology that was never used, never proven, never studied. We were the test here. You got to be specific. And people like to generalize too much. And, you usually discount those people. When their voices are louder than yours because there's too many of them, it's kind of hard, again, to get that information out because Meta says, well, that's disinformation. No, it's not. Polio vaccines are not mRNA technology. The RSV vaccine, all the vaccines that we've used up until this point were not mRNA technology. I've been vaccinated. I had my Hep B vaccine a couple of years ago because I work in the medical field. I'm not anti-vax by any measure of the word. I am anti giving something that has been unproven and untested to the entire population for something you do not need. And when it's been proven not to work, that just makes common sense. So for these folks to yell anti-vax, they obviously are in the pool of population that has that under 100 IQ. But again, they are sometimes louder than everybody. And unfortunately, when they're louder, they seem to control the narrative in this world. And that's the scary thing. That's why we're not going to get anywhere. We really got to calm down, have a discussion. Again, go into this stuff. People still don't understand how testing works, Guy. I have the conversation every day. And it's very interesting when you understand the PCR technology versus the rapid antigen technology. You would throw out those rapids, but people are still running out to the store to get a rapid test, and they think they know what they're talking about. They have no idea what they're talking about. And we're 4 years into this.
So bring that to life a little bit, what people need to understand about testing.
The only proper way to, and there's going to be a lot of people who have looked up PCR testing and they're going to tell you that, they've gone down some rabbit hole. I'm telling them they're wrong. The only proper way to test for COVID is PCR testing. We have used PCR testing for respiratory pathogens for years before COVID existed. No one ever knew what PCR was. It's polymerase chain reaction. It takes a signal and amplifies it. When you amplify that signal, I'm going to tell you how it works. It's the sensitivity is logarithmic. It's not linear. So not to get too sciencey for your audience, but when I take that sample and send it off to the lab, they look for the signal and amplify it. It goes 1, then 10 times, then 100 times, then 1,000, 10,000, 100,000, so on and so on and so on, all the way to level 36. That's where the two labs that I use stop. Looking for COVID at level 1 is like looking for COVID on my cell phone. But looking for COVID at level 36 is like looking for COVID in the solar system, okay? So at the solar system level, the lab only needs 9 copies of the virus to tell me it's in your system and bound, okay? That's called CT value from level 1 to level 36. The higher you go on the CT scale, that's the bigger the sensitivity it needed to find the virus. So anybody who came in between a level 27 and 36 did not have a classic symptom, all right? They had it. It's definitely in their system. And again, I could repeat the data over and over and over. In other words, if you came back, if I had 100 people and you came back positive tomorrow on a PCR test and you didn't believe it because you didn't have a symptom, which again is the norm, I could repeat the data with the same 100 people the next day and get 99 negatives and yours would be positive, okay? A lot of people like to argue PCR testing is too sensitive. And in their hypothesis world, I had 44,000 tests. I had 40,000 negatives and 4,000 positives. In their hypothesis, everybody in my 40,000 negative group, they would have found a positive. That's just not true. It does not happen like that. I can, again, repeat the data over and over and over. So that's how PCR testing is done, but it's very specific. I had a guy come back this week. He was very sick. He had flu A, H1N1, and staph infection. But again, people who discount PCR testing would tell you that it's, you're going to find COVID. No, that's not how PCR works. It's very, very accurate. Again, I could repeat the data. In contrast, though, in rapid antigen test, This is where it gets stupid. You need 10 to the 6th to 10 to the 9th power of virus to turn that rapid card blue. What does that mean? Instead of 9 copies of a virus on a PCR test, I need 9 million to 9 billion. So if you come back positive on a rapid antigen test, you are definitely positive for something. That's the caveat. You can turn positive on a rapid for any coronavirus that we test for 7 in the office, including the common cold. Now, most likely it's COVID, but I've had a lot of COVID positive rapid tests turn into on a PCR validation. It's you know, HKU29, OL, you know, 6, NL63, OL43. There's a whole bunch of different coronaviruses. So you cannot get a specific positive on a rapid, but a negative test on a rapid tells me even less because you need such a spread of virus in order to turn that rapid. So this is what you'd have in practice, right? You'd have the guy who needs a test to go travel somewhere, and they would come in and you would PCR them and they'd come back positive. Well, they don't like the fucking results. Excuse my cursing. So they would run off to Walgreens and they would get a rapid test and they would come back and say, no, I'm negative on that. Well, no, if you're positive on a PCR, you're positive. You need a lot more viruses. So they don't understand that. But, you know, they would manipulate the system to try to get the result they wanted to get. And people will tell you that the sensitivity on PCR is too high. That's not true. The lab values are very, very specific. They're very, very accurate. And I've seen people, because I've done this testing in my office, where I can test you today and test you tomorrow, and I can tell you if that signal is waxing or waning. So if you might be a level 27 today, you might be a level 25 tomorrow. That means it's building in your system, where those people would then eventually develop a minor symptom. Again, when I talk about symptoms, we always think about classic symptoms. So not most people, 80 to 90% do not get a cough, a fever, or shortness of breath. Most common symptom of COVID: headache and then fatigue. Then you would have different symptomology groups in the beginning. You would look at diarrhea and all this other stuff. But again, people have to understand that if you are fighting off a virus and you are pretty healthy, you are, and this goes to what you originally talked about, if you're sleeping well, you're eating right, you're working out, you're pretty healthy, your immune system's pretty good. It's probably going to fight that thing off. If you have COVID and you've developed a bacterial infection on top of that, well, that's going to make it worse and you're probably going to get sick. And that CT value, that value is going to lower because that virus is probably going to build in your system at that point because it has the opportunity to spread because your immune system is run down. I mean, we learn so much through mass testing, but people want to discount it constantly. And you're constantly having this argument. But testing is so important. When you understand testing in totality and you see it the way I see it, it really changes your mind with COVID. So again, I would implore people to just pick up the book. By the way, Guy, I've had this conversation with 4,000 positive patients. And sometimes it'll last an hour, and it got tiring where I finally wrote a book and said, here, just read it. It's here. I can't do this every day, you know.
So I'd like you to watch this link of a, sure, of a conversation I had earlier. So I guess just probably one of my last questions, and just because I'm so alert to time. Your ability to get a message like this out, and there are, you know, many other people now who are verbalizing this, because I think the fear of verbalization probably isn't what it was. But people were suppressed. Their media was shut down. They were taken off Twitter, as was. They were taken off Facebook. And they were, you know, there were people who were, you know, experts in the field. They were verbalizing an opinion and actually, you know, not allowed to talk and comment. So what is the situation now with your ability to get a message out? And even me putting this on, you know, into the world on YouTube or whatever it is, what's going to happen?
It's a good question. I mean, I do an interview almost every day. I have my own show that I do 3 times a week. I have a radio interview tonight in New York. It depends on the news cycle, right? So I was getting a lot of bookings for television shows up until the conflict in Israel started. And then all of a sudden that kind of took over the narrative. It depends on what's going on, right? So Dr. Fauci is now on Capitol Hill testifying, and I got a couple calls for interviews with people waiting to comment. Well, most of the time they're not an hour plus where you're talking about real data. They're 4 minutes. You know, you're doing a hit, and they have an agenda on TV too. You know, what do you think of Dr. Fauci on Capitol Hill today? And what do you want to know? It's like, how much can you get out in 2 seconds, you know, in a 4 minute interview? So the ability stuff, I don't have a direct line to Joe Rogan. I don't know Joe Rogan. He's got 16 million followers. I don't know Tucker Carlson, although I think my publicist pitched him. But you know, a lot of these shows go with the news cycle, with what's going on today, and people have gotten tired of COVID. But as I said, there needs to be a national conversation, because they've set this up so that you can just forget about it and move on to the next thing. And what it's like a flash, didn't happen. It wasn't there, never happened. That's sad, because we affected a lot of lives. Yeah. When I tell you how many 90-year-old birthdays that I watched in nursing homes or assisted living, because the family couldn't come in for years, and the person would turn, you know, 80 or 90, and they're outside 50 feet away through glass with a cake in the cold, having a birthday party, and I'm inside doing the testing, watching this, going, this is reprehensible. And then that person would later die, not of COVID, but of loneliness or, you know, old age, natural causes, whatever it was. What we did, I mean, my friend's father died, and they couldn't go to the funeral. They had to separate. The stuff we did, somebody's got to be held accountable. But when I try to get this message out, I get censored every, you know, at every turn. I did a show in the UK not too long ago. It was called Conservative Renewal. The hosts were great. Within 2 minutes of them going live, they're like, we've just been pulled off YouTube. We weren't talking anything except about how testing works. This is how testing works. This is how PC, you know, our testing works and how it's measured. And, you know, you're not saying anything controversial. I'm not up here saying, you know, Fauci.
So I can wrap my head around, though I fundamentally disagree, that at the peak of it, the government has overreach and does certain things that are not right, i.e. to silence people with a voice. Absolutely wrong. But I can see that at this point, this many years on, is that still happening?
Yes, big time.
And that's the bit that says, I can understand a panic response. What I struggle with is, I mean, I understand a panic response, I don't agree with it, but what I find difficult is X amount of years on, that is still happening. And what is the motive behind that?
People, when you tell people that, you're telling a layperson who doesn't do TV, they don't do radio, they don't have data, they work somewhere, you know, when you tell them that you get censored, they look at you like you're crazy. They think you're a conspiracy theorist that, you know, have a screw loose. And you're going, dude, again, I don't come to your job and tell you how to do it. Like, we mitigate, we do this stuff every day. When you see it happening to you every day, it's quite stark. Meta is the biggest culprit. Amazon, YouTube. I do a show on Rumble. Rumble lets you say whatever you want, and that's great. You know, we love Rumble so far. YouTube's been the biggest culprit besides Meta, though. If I post a picture of my big toe on Facebook, I'll get, you know, 130, 200, 300, 400 people will like it. If I post a link to my book, two people will see it. It's kind of crazy. And when I do interviews that get pulled down, like I was on a show, the woman was in Virginia, and she was on four different platforms streaming, and two of them pulled them down right away. I forget what the second one was, but the first one was YouTube. And I wasn't surprised at that point, because it's happened over and over and over. So you see a pattern. And again, this is what we do. We look at patterns and trends. And
do you have any way of contacting those organizations to say, what are the rules that are being broken? Is this some adjudicator that some student somewhere in the middle of bloody nowhere? Or is it actually, are you big enough to say, hold on a minute, can some sort of verified tick go against my name, which means I don't get suppressed like this?
Because big enough is subjective, right? I mean, I've contacted Amazon because Amazon's one of my book distributors. I'm on Ingram Spark and Amazon. And Amazon sent me three separate letters saying that they will not let me promote the book. And I have the letters, and it says right there, due to current events. That's their words, current events. Okay. No one at Amazon has read this book. They have looked at this cover and made an assumption of what's in this book. And that's where I get a lot of pushback too. I'll do interviews. I'll post our interview when we're done and you send it to me. And somebody out in the world will get upset if they see the cover of this book, and they'll get triggered and make an assumption. And I had my uncle the other day, who hasn't read the book. He's on the other side. He said to me the other day, he goes, I disagree with you about Fauci. And I said, disagree with what? I go, he's mentioned three times in the book. Could you point to something specific? He hasn't read the book. He just thinks that I'm bashing Fauci in the book, which I don't, by the way. I don't bash Fauci at all. Whether I agree with the way he handled the situation, no, I don't agree. When you look at the data, You, again, I leave it to the audience to say, well, here's the data. Here's what we saw as practitioners. Now you can decide whether you think they did it right or wrong. And I think you'd come to the conclusion that they either weren't. One host on television asked me yesterday, he had a whole bunch of words to describe Fauci. And I said, well, you might want to add the word stupidity, because if they knew what we knew as early as we knew it, there's no way that they would have done this unless there was some kind of something nefarious going on. You don't shut down people's lives and watch people die through windows for 90-year-old birthday parties. You don't do that with a conscience if you understand that this thing wasn't that the mortality rate was going to be that of the flu. If we knew that as early on as we did, they had to know that. But maybe they weren't looking at our data. I think in the beginning they were trying to take as many precautions as possible, and then I think they used what was going on to exploit the situation. What is that? Saul Alinsky's book, Rules for Radicals, Never Let a Crisis Go to Waste. I think you had a lot of people that got loud and kept this crisis going when we could have mitigated this very, very quickly.
So we do get into things like this idea of the Great Reset and what all lots of things might be happening, which, again, you know, different podcast and we could go down, you know, what that might entail. But what would be the motivation? What is that motivation to keep it going?
Well, I think, again, if you look at our country, it was an election that year. And a lot of people said, oh, as soon as the election's over, you'll see COVID disappear. And I mean, it kind of did. But I could tell you how the government made COVID disappear. It's really simple, actually. People just don't correlate it. It was the CARES Act, and it was rapid testing, and people don't understand reporting. So, like, before the CARES Act existed, you had to have a symptom to get tested. So the numbers were relatively low. It was like this, right? And then the CARES Act comes out in the U.S., and it allows anybody to get a test at any time. So you could come in and say, I was exposed to my cousin's girlfriend's father's brother's roommate. I need a test. Okay, fine. We'd have to give you a test legally. So you see the numbers go here, because when you test everybody in the country at the same time, or in the world, in your case, you see the numbers go exponentially high. Everybody's got it. Okay. Then all of a sudden, two things happen. The rapid test comes out. Well, those numbers don't get reported. You're not at home getting a rapid test from the grocery store and then calling the county or whoever and saying, the government saying, I'm positive, I need to isolate. You're not doing that. So those don't get reported. So the numbers go artificially here. Then the CARES Act in the U.S. expired, and the emergency order stopped on May, I think it was 12th of 2023. Well, guess what? No one can go and get a test anymore because the rules aren't the same. You have to have a symptom. And if you remember, 85 to 90% of my patients didn't have a symptom. So now the numbers go from here to here. And that's how the government made COVID disappear. If you want the numbers to come back, if you want another crisis, institute an emergency order and the CARES Act again, or something like the CARES Act, and let anyone at any time get a COVID test at any time. But you'd have to get rid of the rapids, because the rapids have distorted that. So if you want the numbers to go through the roof again, reinstitute the CARES Act emergency order, get rid of rapid tests. Everyone will have to come to a doctor where those numbers get reported, and you'll see the numbers go straight through there, because COVID is still out there just as much as it was before. I had a patient come in the other day, and she got rapid tested, and some idiot doctor put her on Paxlovid through a telehealth. And she came to us, and I said, why are you using Paxlovid? Like, you know, number one, you don't need it. We get a lot of Paxlovid. We stopped using it 2+ years ago, maybe after a month of trying it. And she goes, yeah, I was kind of nervous about that. And I looked at her, and I'm like, you basically have no symptoms. Like, she was on Paxlovid. She took one dose for a day. She had no symptoms when she came in. I said, what was your concern? She goes, oh, I just got nervous it was going to get worse. I looked at her. I said, you have no fever. Your vitals are great. I said, you're going to feel better in a day or two. So we tested her. I called her the next day to tell her, called her yesterday to tell her that she was COVID positive on a PCR. So it was confirmatory, you know, because you got to confirm the rapid. And I said, how are you feeling today? She goes, I'm feeling great. I'm out running around doing this, that, and the other thing. And she goes, I'm going to go back to work on Friday. Like, you could see it. You could literally predict it. I had a family of three, you know, overweight husband and wife who was a little bit older, and then a young kid who was like 19. I'd look at them and go to the overweight guy, and I'd go, you're going to be sick for about a week. I'd look at the wife and go, you're going to be about 3 days. And I look at the kid and go, you're going to be out running a mile tomorrow. And you call the next day to see how they're doing. And that was exactly the scenario. You get really good at doing this when you do it that many times. And there's still people out there who are freaking out and running to the hospital, you know, stockpiling rapid tests. Stop it, people. There's a lot more to life. And by the way, we didn't even get into, Guy, I know you're short on time. I know you got to go, but we didn't even get into the masks. I write so much on them. That was the second dumbest thing I've ever seen in my career. We do not wear masks for viruses. And there's reasons. And when you understand air fluidity and particle size and how many particles it takes to infect you.
Yeah. I mean, listen, if it's like smoking and having, when we used to have no smoking zones in restaurants, you go, well, the smoke doesn't know where the zone is, right? So right. You can, I mean, just at that level, I have to say, so hold on then, this airborne virus only goes in a straight line, does it? Mm-hmm. And it gets to my mask, which I, by the way, can smell your perfume through, right. Or I can smell whatever through. And apparently this mask is so good, right, that it stops the virus going round the corners. And so right. I know nothing about it, and I'm already going, I'm sorry, this is BS.
It's stupid. I had one guy, he's a real nice guy, used to tell me he's an RN, and he was like, well, and he came up with this analogy because he saw this meme. And he goes, well, here's Johnny. And he goes, and Johnny's wearing pants. And then here's next to his twin brother who's not wearing pants. And they both have to pee. And he goes, the one that's wearing pants, the pee didn't go anywhere. It just got caught in the pants. I go, that's not how it works. He wasn't, you know, people will look at memes and think like, you know, I go, that's not how it works. Particle size is important, right? You could fit 500 million COVID particles on a pinhead, 500 million. And particle size becomes so important. Anything less than 0.25 microns doesn't settle by gravity. It's too small. So it won't settle. It looks like this. Well, my vape pen's running out, but you get the point. They're literally floating around in space. Now, when you could fit 500 million on a pinhead and somebody is symptomatic in a room coughing, you are walking around amongst millions and billions of particles. It only takes one live particle to infect you. One. So that mask, by the way, that surgical mask everybody's wearing, wasn't duct taped to your face. Okay. If it was duct taped to your face, you'd be using the filter. Now, if you get into the filter conversation, well, the filter on the surgical mask is rated for 3 microns. COVID is 0.1 microns, 30 times smaller than the filter size on the mask. So I mean, we were doing stupidity upon stupidity upon stupidity. And you're going to get your best protection from a properly fitted N95 mask, okay? Properly fitted. They weren't saying that. So if you were telling us we could go on planes but wear, you know, stockings or a bandana and you're good, that's BS to me. If Fauci and Birx and everybody else in our country had come out and said, okay, you can travel on a plane, but you have to wear a properly fitted N95 mask, I would have said, okay, I'm going to give them some credence. They didn't do that. They were just doing stupid upon stupid upon stupid. And when you're very specific, as I am in my business, you like to talk in, you know, in facts and data and make sure that you can analyze it appropriately. What we did was just dumb. We should have been very honest with the world from the start, telling them how masks work, how viruses spread, timelines, all that fun stuff. We got all that out in the beginning. We could have gotten that out in the first week or two. We could have mitigated this so much better.
So in theory, you cannot tell me that the people at the CDC do not know about micron sizing and couldn't just go, well, listen, the people aren't stupid. If we tell them that something that's that size will be stopped by something that doesn't filter it, we're going to look like a bunch of idiots.
Well, again, it wasn't duct taped to your face. If I put a mask on right now and I had a vape pen that was working, you'd see the steam, like you said, come out up here on the sides. That's where you're breathing, through the path of least resistance. And then the people that argue the opposite will say, well, it has to stop something. I will tell you what the mask did. They did one thing. They made it worse. Because you're breeding a warm, moist environment for bacterial growth. So a lot of folks that were wearing these things all day were coming back with staph infections, Moraxella catarrhalis, H flu, Klebsiella pneumonia. We saw a ton of bacterial respiratory infections during COVID because people were wearing these masks that weren't sanitary. They're in their car. They're in their pocket. They're on the table. I mean,
yeah, they weren't using a fresh one every day, right?
No, but even if you did, people were thinking they were getting a force field, you know, protection. I the hundreds of calls, guy, of in the beginning, like I said, oh, I don't understand how I'm positive and wearing a mask the whole time. You just want to roll your horizon, you know where they fit on that IQ scale. It's sad what we did. We took advantage of people. Maybe the CDC thought everybody in this country was dumb and didn't want to give them the specifics. But I think if you rolled out a 10-point, here's the specifics, here's what you need to know. Again, we could have stopped a lot of this nonsense. And when you're not going to look, people think today to this day that you are going to get less sick if you get the COVID vaccine. Okay, but no one's ever asked somebody like me what the numbers are. Guess what? They're exactly the same. the asymptomatic versus symptomatic classic symptomology for pre-vaccine existence, pre-shot, let's call it a shot, what it really is, and post-shot existence is exactly the same. So it is borderline malpractice to tell somebody you're going to get less sick with COVID if you've been vaccinated. It is such BS. We have the data. It's right there. And by the way, all the issues that we're seeing from these vaccines, and you've heard of the cardiomyopathy, the heart issues, the joint issues. I see a lot of joint issues. We're starting to see cancer in abundance, especially in young people. We're talking about an abundance of lymphoma right now. I always point out this chart because it's stark, and Dr. Jancy Lindsay and I are working together on a second book. 30 years of data, right, for stillborn births related to vaccines. 30 years of data, 25 or less for 30 years. 2021, 3,600. 2022, 1,600. That's data that's right in front of you, folks, that you can see. What did we do different 2021, 2022? It's not that hard to see, guys. It's right in front of you, but nobody wants to talk about it. And if you talk about it on shows like this, you get pulled down. For what? Telling the truth? Talking about data? I'm not telling you an opinion. I'm telling you what the data tells you. You can formulate your own opinion.
Okay. So listen. I could keep going, but I'm alert to people's attention spans. And I think your book, Fauci's Fiction, is something people should look up. I'll put the link to it in the description. It's been a joy, Mike, listening to you talk. I only understood about 25% of what you were saying, but that's okay. I understood the pronouns. I get where you're coming from. I understand the message that you've got. There are things there for me to look up and pay attention to. And I do think that we should have a curiosity around this subject. I think we should have it on two things. I don't think we need to understand the science like a scientist, but we should understand the essence of facts. And I think also we should look at the way that we were communicated to, because insert next issue here. Actually, it is important to get better at the public being able to make its own mind up and make grown-up decisions, as it is to understand what it is that we're getting. So those things definitely are key. So listen, I think you're doing a service. I thank you for it. I think it's, you know, you're obviously somebody that is driven and has integrity and has a reason to do these things. And I appreciate it and I value it. And so I'm just going to ask you to stay on for a few moments just while we kind of make sure everything uploads. But from me and from everybody listening to the show, I just want to say thank you so much for making the time. Hugely appreciated and valued.
I appreciate it a lot. Thank you.
That's it. So I hope you enjoyed the episode. Please share so others get to hear about us, and subscribe so you keep up to date on new episodes. Also visit livingbrave.com if you want to connect with me and find out more about executive coaching, team effectiveness, and changing culture. Oh, and of course, you can buy my book, Living Brave Leadership, on Amazon. So on that note, see you soon.